and took a bath. I'm Marie Lucas, and I'm an alcoholic. God, you're all looking good. Bob only has a two-hour tape in, and I just checked the program. And if you all want to go to Tabby House, like the program says, is at 8:30, you go right ahead. If I'm not finished, you know, you go ahead. I'll be here till I finish. I came a long way with a lot of difficulty today. My husband got me up at 6 just so that I'd be ready at 8. It takes me 30 minutes. I was all packed, ready to go. And I rode down with friends, and we had to replace two belts. And I'm going back with another friend. I'm going to check her belts before we leave. So it's been a long day. And then the air conditioning went out. So I was in a cold bathtub at 4:30. And I'm ready to go. I'm just here to share with you what my life has been like. And I don't think I've ever been in a room before where I've had the most sobriety. And it doesn't mean a thing. I still make a lot of meetings, and I still hang out with a lot of women. And I'm still very active in Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous is my life. And without it, I wouldn't have life. When I came to AA, I had to change all of my habits. Had to change all of my friends. And I had to go to different places and do different things. And Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me how to do that. And I don't have to do it alone. I have you women to walk with me through any situation in my life. And that's what you've done for me for 31 years. And I'm grateful. I'd like to thank Lib and the committee, Janet, and all the rest. I don't know you by name. Don't know you by face. But thank you for inviting me. It's so nice to be able to come someplace and be with other women that understand. We feel different and we live different, and life is just a little different for us than it is out there in those mixed group meetings. And that's what's so special about a weekend like this. This is a safe place for you, no matter whether you've been here before or not. This is a safe haven. You can share what you're feeling. Alcoholics Anonymous is an organization that's not just here in Georgia or Tennessee or Texas or anywhere. It's a worldwide organization, and isn't it wonderful that we have several million members now? And no matter where you go, you can find Alcoholics Anonymous, usually in the phone book. Or if you go to the police station, they might know where the meeting is. And I've gone to police stations and they didn't know what I was talking about. But usually you can find a meeting no matter where you go. And we have contacts all over the country, and we have what we call a world directory that's a buck and a half. And it's a buck and a half for the Eastern Division and a buck and a half for the Western Division. And it's the best money you'll ever invest if you're going to do some traveling. And I've used it extensively. It's a worldwide organization of men and women. And in this organization, they presented me with a big book. And this big book had several definitions of an alcoholic in it. And I had heard many definitions when I first came into the program. I could not guarantee my behavior after the first drink, and that was certainly true, because the second drink and the third drink tasted a lot better than the first. And after I had the sixth, it really didn't make any difference. So I could not guarantee my behavior, and I could not control my drinking after I took the first drink. And for those of you that might be Al-Anon or in another 12-step program, try one cashew or one potato chip, one Whitman sampler. That's just a mild comparison of what it's like for the alcoholic, believe me. But I could not guarantee my behavior after the first drink. But the definition that suits me the best is the one in the big book, a self-will run riot. And that's exactly what my life was like in December of 1962. Now, some of you were probably not even born then. You were probably a twinkle in your daddy's eye. But I was 39 years old at that time. So quick, add it up. Yes, I'm 70. So you see, I didn't have all this gray hair and I didn't have all these miles on me when I came into the program either. But I've learned so much and I've grown up. And I know what I want to be when I grow up. Jean still doesn't know what she wants to be when she grows up. Wasn't it you today that said you didn't know what you wanted to be when you grew up? She's running out of time. I have to take you on a little tour. And again, this is only my story. Don't take it as being the only story you ever hear in Alcoholics Anonymous. Come and hear more, and hear more after you leave these meetings. I am only one example of several million members. So listen with an open mind and see where you can identify. Don't analyze my story, utilize it. I was born in New York City. I'm the oldest of three girls. My father was a very strict German, and he was a railroad man. And our home was strict, structured, and scheduled. And my mother was born in Austria, and she was a very passive woman. Daddy was very abusive in many ways, and very abusive to me as a child. And after I left high school, I went to work in New York City. And this was in the time of the big Archie Bunker War. And I snuck my typewriter out of the house, my portable. And I took the test to work for the federal government. And I flunked the first time because I was so nervous. But I passed the second time I took it. And in April of 1942, my father had given me $100 and told me never to ask him for anything else in my life, and I didn't get it. And I moved from New York to Washington, D.C. I had a job, a very good job with the government, and I had a place to stay. I went to the Y, and they had a room registry, and I moved into a boarding house with 10 other young women. And the phone was always ringing because some of those women had been there for a while and they had made some friends here and there, and they were always needing one more girl to go here, there, or someplace. And we were going to the military bases in the neighborhood around D.C. So I put my hand up in the air. I caught on quickly. And we had the pint purse and the fifth purse. If we were going to Virginia, we took the fifth purse because they didn't serve alcohol. But there was always something going on. It was either Navy or Marines or Army or Air Force or whatever. I was right in there. And this is when I started to drink. I had no drinking through my young teen years until I left home. Then I met a Marine one time that was going to teach me how to drink beer. Now, what do you need to learn? You bend your elbow and you drink it. He taught me. He moved on. 42, 43, New Year's Eve, I met a flyboy. And in 43, he gave me his wings. In 44, he gave me a diamond. And in 1945... We were married. And that's 49 years ago, and yes, we're still married, and we haven't killed each other yet. My best buddy. So we started on that happy road. Into married life, and he decided to stay in the Air Force. And now I have to take you to a few different places and kind of highlight what it was like. But first, I have to tell you that we've had 9 children, and then I sobered up. I had a baby every other year, so if I forget to put one in or tell you about it, you go ahead. From 1947 until 1963, I had my last baby 2 months after I sobered up, and I haven't had any since. I found out where they were coming from. That's how I used to make amends, I guess. I never thought of that. So in 1947, we had our first son, and 49, we had our first daughter, and 51, we had our second daughter. And during this period of time, we were in Washington, D.C., and he flew with the VIP squadron there out of Washington National. And it was a good job. Good job, good money. And we had a lot of fun, a lot of friends. And in 1951, we were transferred to Paris, France with General Eisenhower. And we went to Paris, and we took 3 children. And in 53, I had a little boy over there in the American hospital. Now, our pattern of drinking, or my pattern of drinking, kind of changed when we got to Paris because I had a full-time maid. And I had no responsibility. I didn't work. I didn't have to do anything. And all the American women kind of hung together, and especially the crew wives. And we did a lot of partying. We got the Rosenthal china and the crystal, and we had the wine and the liqueurs and the special glasses and the special silver, and the maid would serve it, and you'd tinkle the bell, and they'd come and serve. And it was living. And no problem. And no problem, because I had no responsibility. In 1953, we were transferred to Germany, and it was more of the same with a German maid. Only here I remember one instance of waking up on the floor on my stomach next to the bed, wondering what happened. And nothing was ever said. When we came back from overseas, we asked for East Coast duty. We got Seattle, Washington. And that was typically Air Force at the time. I don't know if they still do the same thing. But we went to Seattle, and we stayed there for 3 months, and then we moved down to Sacramento, California, to McClellan Air Force Base. I had another baby in 55, another girl. We have 7 girls, if I didn't say that, and we've had 2 boys. Now, all of a sudden, I had to have his uniform starched and pressed and in the corner and ready to go all the time, you know, a clean one every day. And I had to have the meals on the table, and I had to take the children here, and I had to take the older ones to scouts and baseball, and I had to do all this, and I had all this responsibility. And I used to tell my mother I'm about to have a nervous breakdown, but that's not what it was. It was withdrawal from the quantity I had been drinking overseas and accepting my responsibility. It was a difficult period here, and I'd beg Luke, just bring home a half a pint or a pint, or let's go up to that piano bar and have a couple drinks. And sometimes he'd oblige, and most of the time he wouldn't. On July the 29th of 1956, I was 7 months pregnant. The son that had been born in Paris was killed by a drunken driver right in front of the house. And this was devastating. I know now that I went into shock. The doctor suggested that my husband send me back east. And I left just shortly after the funeral with the children and came back east. And I've made amends many times to my husband because I threw all the mess of clearing everything up and all the legalities in his lap. But he accepted it, and he did well, and he drove east, and he got there just before the next baby was born. Now, when we got to our new station on Cape Cod, Massachusetts, Otis Air Force Base, my drinking changed. I drank for different reasons. It was no longer fun, and quantity made no difference to me, or my condition made no difference to me. Our relationship deteriorated, to say the least, and I went my own way. I worked in a motel that had a bar, and it was also a coffee shop, and I worked for a woman that was older than myself. And we had a deal, you know, one of us would drink, and one of us would tend bar and take care of the business. So I could drink as I so chose, and I never even had to pay for it. But I would look at people behind that bar, on the other side of that bar, and I would say, if I ever get as bad as they are, I'll do something. But I wasn't that bad. And it kind of healed the pain of the grief. I didn't know there was such a thing as a grief process. I didn't know there was any such thing as going to a minister or a priest and talking about how I was feeling or trying to solve what I was feeling. I just stuffed it with more booze and more booze. I started drinking Manhattans and martinis when I first started drinking. But now through this period, I was starting to drink anything I could get my hands on. And before it was all over, I was drinking Boilermakers like any other truck driver, you know, a shot and a beer or a double shot and a beer if I could afford it. And that was my pattern. All of the fears and frustrations of alcoholism started to set in. In 1958, I had another little girl, and in 1959, Hollis got out of the service, and we moved off base, and he got a job. And like I say, it was not all peachy roses and keen living in those days. We were never coordinated with the utility companies. We either had gas and electric and no water, or and that's before the days of Pampers. We had cloth diapers in those days. And it wasn't, you know, somebody was always knocking on the door or calling on the phone, and then sometimes it'd be a fight and the phone was pulled out of the wall. And then he'd take the carburetor out of my car so I couldn't drive, and it was chaotic. In 1961, just before Valentine's Day, he decided to seek his fortune in California, so he left with the only car we had and the few dollars we had, and I had an eviction notice in my hand and the electric had been turned off. So here I was with six children, expecting my seventh within a week, and there I was. The baby was born, and in March, about 6 weeks later, I moved the whole kit and caboodle down to his family homestead. Now this is where the insanity starts setting in. And I don't know whether you women have ever pointed the finger, but I could do it so well with his family, you know, your brother, your cousin, your so-and-so. If he hadn't, I wouldn't. And if he would only, I wouldn't have to be here. And I lived with his sister, and she had four children, and we had no inside plumbing, and oh, it was backwoods, believe me. It was podunk. And it was very difficult, but if Louise wanted to go out for a drink, guess who had her hand in the air? Or if Louise wanted to have a few drinks and she wanted me to go to the liquor store, guess who had her hand in the air? So I'd sneak a bottle under the seat of the car or in my purse, and I'd have a little extra for me. And if somebody was going to mix drinks, I mix them, you know, a half a shot for you and a double for me. And that's how it went along. 3 months later, he came back, and his admission was that he had a problem with drinking. And would I take him back if he didn't drink anymore? Well, I'd have been a fool if I hadn't taken him back. So I took him back, and we made a new home in Columbus, Ohio. And things went along wonderful, absolutely wonderful, for 6 weeks. You're ahead of me. Columbus, Ohio gets hot and humid in the summer. I had gotten a job, and he had gotten a job, and Friday night was payday. And I can remember it like it was yesterday. We'll just get 1 6-pack, and that's all we got, along with the Friday night groceries. Guess what the next week? 2 6-packs, and then it was a couple 6-packs and a fifth, and a couple fifths and a 6-pack, and he's going his way and I'm going mine. Now, I don't know whether you ever hid bottles or did anything like that, but we always had a bottle in the kitchen that we marked. That was the joint bottle, but I always had a bottle someplace else, and he did too. Now, the only difference between his drinking and my drinking was I was functioning. I was vertical. I was in the kitchen all the time. You know, the kids are running around. I'm the dedicated mother. I'm taking care of everything, but I'm drinking too. He'd be passed out on the couch, so he's the alcoholic. You know, there I am pointing the finger to anybody that would listen. Well, anyway, we things went on and got worse, if that's possible. The blankouts were periods of time would lapse and I couldn't account for myself. And by now I had taken my drinking to the bar because my older children were saying, you drink more than Mary's mom or David's mom or whoever's mom. And so I would come home from work and I would check and count noses and make sure everybody was there and they had something for dinner. And I would proceed to the neighborhood bar, which was located between the supermarket and a variety store. So on any pretense, a quart of milk or notebook paper or one of those special folders or pencils or whatever, I would proceed to the store, but I'm just going to have one. And then somebody sets the bar up, so I have to drink that. Then I have to reciprocate. Then somebody tells a story. Then I can't remember whether I took the milk home for the baby's bottle. And I have to call home and say, did the baby go to bed? No, Mom, we're waiting for the milk. And I'd run home with the milk. And then longer periods of time would lapse, you know, and I'd make these promises to the kids. And you promised to take the Girl Scout troop to the circus today. It's Tuesday. When did I promise? Last Tuesday when I went to the meeting? I didn't remember. I didn't know. And my life was really, really not good. I realized in the middle of 62 that I was pregnant again. And I can honestly say I didn't want to be pregnant again. It was not on my agenda for that year. I was working for the federal government as an accounting clerk. And I just had some important papers out the other day, and I read my job evaluation, and it's amazing. I don't know how I did it. But the reason I was not that word, alcoholic, was because I performed every day. I did everything that needed to be done, and I didn't start drinking until 5 o'clock at night. And my weekends were a drunken brawl. Well, the latter part of that year, the early part of 62, I had been placed on probation for checks insufficient funds. Now, this is the days, it's probably hard for some of you to remember, before computers. And you could beat a check to the bank. You can't do that anymore. I don't know for sure, but I wouldn't try it. But my checks were written to supermarkets. I paid my bar bill, and I kept enough money back to take care of my liquor. And my checks were written to supermarkets. And I could go every month and report while I was on probation, you know, and tell them what a no-good SOB he was, and point the finger. And I would just barely get about a mile up the road, and I'd have to stop and have a drink. And that was it. You know, I could put on that false front. I have to tell you one more story about hiding bottles on my husband. He thought he was losing his mind, and he'd write himself a note before he went to bed, bottle under third cushion of the green couch. And he'd put the note in his wallet, and he'd go pass out. Well, this vertical drunk would go find his wallet, find the bottle, and you know what I did with the bottle. And the next morning, he'd be wandering around just really bleeding to death. And he'd say, I'd say, well, what's the matter? What are you doing? Well, here's my note. I said it was under the green couch, you know, and it's not there. Well, I don't know. You must have got up during the night and drank it or something. He thought he was losing it, and I let him think that. Now, that went on for a long time. I did that a lot of times. On December 27th of 1962, my probation was revoked. And my children always knew where to get a hold of me, you know, the dedicated mother. They called me at the bar and they said, Mom, there's two women and a man here to see you. And I said, Linda, I'm not coming home. And I didn't go home, mainly because quick like that, there's no court until the 2nd of January. And I don't know if any of you have ever had to run, but I had to run for that long weekend. I came back into Columbus on the 1st, and all I could keep down was mushroom soup. And I had about a half a can of beer that day, and that was about the extent of my drinking that day. And that was my last drink. On the 2nd of January, I went down to the courthouse, and I knew what they wanted, and I knew right where to go. I stopped at the house and left the kids a note and did a few things or picked up a few things and took the bus downtown, left the car there. And I was sentenced to a year at the Ohio Reformatory for Women, 7 months pregnant. And I got there with no knowledge of Alcoholics Anonymous. No knowledge at all. I didn't know it existed, especially for women. And when I was pregnant, I carried 9-pound babies, so I was pregnant all over, and they just said, go sit in that rocker. And I went and sat in that rocker, and there was nothing to read in what they call isolation, where you stay for the first 30 days. And I did a lot of thinking, and it didn't take long for me to think through. Had it not been for my selfish desire to drink, I wouldn't have thrown 7 kids to the wind, and I wouldn't be sitting behind bars. My life had certainly become unmanageable, to say the least. And I was now told when to stand up and when to sit down and when to go eat and when to go to bed and when to get up and when to everything. And at the end of that first 30 days, there was a woman that interviewed me, and she was like an angel in my life. Her name was Mrs. Jones, and she was old enough to be my mother. And they interview you to find out why you did what you did or try to figure it out. And at the end of that interview, she said, would you be interested in the Alcoholics Anonymous program? And I said, yes, if you think it'll help me to understand my husband's drinking problem. So the early part of February of 1962, I came to my first meeting. And I don't know how you felt when you came, but the only way I can think about it now is to look back, and my life was like the shell of an egg, very fragile and hollowed out. And in these 31 years, you have put life into that egg, step by step by step. I did what they call easy time because I had a little bit of money and I could buy toilet articles or whatever I needed. And I worked for the school principal as his secretary, and I had a lot of freedoms, and I became very active in the Alcoholics Anonymous program, and we had a publication that we exchanged with other institutions. And I met the parole board on the day and the hour that Kennedy was shot. And I had to wait an hour until they found out for sure that he was dead before I met the parole board. I was granted my freedom, and I left the institution just a few days before Christmas of 63 to absolutely nothing. The clothes that I had had were not worth having, and everything was in storage. And I went to my sister-in-law's house, the same sister-in-law, and my two oldest children were living there. And I went to a meeting a night or two later on a Sunday night, and that's where my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous started. At that time in AA, there were very few women, and I had three men sponsors. And they were wonderful men, and they taught me the Alcoholics Anonymous program by the big book. We have a lot of other tools that we use in the program, but the Alcoholics Anonymous program is in the big book and in the 12 and 12 and in any of the Alcoholics Anonymous literature that you can find. And that's where I started. They suggested I work a step a month. I came to believe. And I let that concrete wall down, and I let God back in my life. And I certainly needed help in being restored to sanity. I had done many insane things. Many, many insane things. And if you haven't seen the movie When a Man Loves a Woman, don't miss it. They did a pretty good job. It's thought-provoking. It was for me. I made the decision to turn my will, that self-will run riot, and my life over to the care of God as I understand Him. Now, my God's not out there someplace. My God is right here. Because so many times, there were times that this little voice within me would say, that's not becoming of a wife or a mother or a woman or a lady. Don't do it. And I'd go hell-bent for election. But now I listen for that voice. I listen for God's direction. I listen for God's will. And God was certainly with us in that car today. Believe me. Ask me later, I'll tell you the details. The The first inventory I took was in the institution, and it was an 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper, and I folded it in 4 parts. And I didn't know how to do this, but I was willing to do it. And I had my assets and liabilities and his assets and liabilities. I had this sheet full. But this side, you know, I had a little difficulty with. I'm still pretty good at that. But in sobriety and outside sobriety, my inventories have been totally different. And yes, I still work the 12 steps a step a month. And yes, I just took another fifth step. And I became responsible for things that I never thought I would become responsible for. But it seemed like numerous meetings I went to this year, in my fifth month, in the month of May, they talked about responsibility. And it just bugged the daylights out of me. So I had to get rid of some garbage, and I did, and I feel a lot better for it. So maybe you don't have that much garbage, I don't know, but I certainly did. I took the fifth step the first time, right after I came home, and I went to the Episcopal priest, and sat with him for about 3 hours. And in our church, they give you the absolution, which means that, you know, okay, you've admitted it was wrong, don't do it again, and everything will be all right. And I really felt good when I left there. And on down the path, the defects of character, I feel, are the things that are as a result of our drinking. I no longer have to write hot checks or steal money or cheat or lie or do any of those things that I used to do when I was drinking. I no longer have to do those things. Oh, once in a while something will creep in, you know, or the checking account will get down a little low and I'll go ATM some money out of savings and put it in checking and, you know, those kinds of things. But nothing of that major proportion that I did under the influence. And I can account for myself most of the time. You know, I know where I was. I have a clear head. Shortcomings are my quick tongue, my control issues. I didn't control too bad today. I was a real good girl. Yeah. I wasn't in my own car, so I couldn't control. I only put the brake on a few times. My quick tongue. I sometimes put my mouth in gear before I put my head in gear, but that's okay. We go on down, and through the years, you know, I made amends to my family, and my mom and dad would come and visit, and they'd say, "You still have to go to those meetings?" And I'd say, "Yes." And little did they know that I needed the meeting worse when they came to visit than I did ordinarily. You know, I've been cleaning for days. But down through the steps, I think we live by 10, 11, and 12. I have to continue to take a personal inventory. And I hate like the devil to admit when I'm wrong. So I'll wait till he's almost asleep, and I'll poke him and ask him to apologize. But then he does the same thing to me. But we work a program. He has his, I have mine, and we have ours. And that's the way it's been down through the years. My favorite step is step 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understand him. And to me, it's the constant conscious contact with God. It's not just morning and night. It's constantly. God be with me. God help me. God put the words in my mouth to help this woman. God help me while I'm on the telephone. God, you know, God be there. And God is there for me. There are times when I don't feel quite as close. And the way my early sponsors explained that is he's busy with another drunk. Just keep dialing. Just keep dialing. And it's really a matter of who moved. You know, it's usually me. I've prayed for God's will in my life. There's a lot of times I don't like it. Sometimes the answer to prayer is yes, and sometimes it's no, and sometimes it's maybe. Sometimes it's wait. And there was one instance in our life in sobriety that we waited 5 years for the answer to a prayer, and it came back affirmative. So it was worth waiting for. It was a powerful thing in our lives. But then sometimes God says, you got to be kidding. But we go on through, and then we've had a spiritual awakening. We've let God into our lives maybe for the first time. You know, I don't have that Sunday school relationship with God. It's a feeling. It's a spirit. It's within me. It's all around me. And God works through you a lot of times to answer prayers that I've been praying for a long time. And then maybe I can answer some of your prayers. And that's how God works. And I had that spiritual awakening, and I've tried to carry this message, and I've carried it all across the country, the same story I'm telling you tonight. I don't have one for you and one for somebody else and another one somewhere else. This is my life. I have no secrets. And I have to share with you, I have a friend in Reno, and her daughter is in the program, and her daughter was just about 18 years old. And this was just about 5 years ago, and Becky came up to me and she said, you said from the podium tonight you have no secrets. And I said, that's right, what do you want to know? She said, do you and Holla still have sex? And I said, yes. No secrets. You know, ask. But what are the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous? To me, I learned them as the absolutes in Ohio: honesty, love, purity, and unselfishness. And that's a good key to life: honesty, love, purity, and unselfishness. Now I have to back up and take you back to where we were in 1964. I was getting ready to celebrate my second AA birthday with my husband on the 1st of January, 65. And my daughter called me at work that day, and she said, Mom, Daddy just came home drunk. And I said, he couldn't, Linda. And she said, yes, he came home drunk. So I picked up my two-year chip and my two-year cake, and he went out there and experimented again for a while. And that was a very difficult time. I became acquainted with Al-Anon. I got the ODAT book, and I went to Al-Anon meetings faithfully through this period. But things got really bad, and I decided I'd have to file for divorce. God wasn't living down here with this guy, and he wasn't helping me make the car payment and pay the rent, and I was having a rough time. So the Al-Anon suggested that I go to see this priest that was in the program. And I went to see him, and he knew who I was. Now, mind you, this is 1967. And I made comment about his music and what we had been doing in AA and so forth and so on. And he wanted to know why I was there, and I told him. And he asked me to repeat my marriage vows. And I thought, well, this is strange, but I'll try. So for richer or poorer, he's not bringing his paycheck home. And for better or worse, it's a whole lot worse. You know, I'm carrying the load with 8 children. And things are not good. And then he stopped me and he asked me if I was active in the public information program. And this is when public information first came out, was 1967. And I was very active in it, going to the schools on the west side of Columbus, and my friends were coming to my side of Columbus. And I said, oh, yes, and I was real excited about it. And he said, what were some of the other vows you said? And I said, in sickness and in health. And yes, I recognize alcoholism as a disease, very definitely. And I took my husband in sickness and in health. And it just happened by coincidence, ha ha, that he went to treatment for the last time right around that same week and has been sober ever since, and I withdrew the divorce proceedings. So we just never know. We have to take another look at it, and we have to be very careful. In 1968, my husband went into the home building business. He had been a carpenter, and he had a lot of fears with that. And he went into that business and built us our first house in 1968, and we had filed for bankruptcy in 64, and we never thought that we'd be able to own the house. And we were able to assume that loan, and we were able to make some material gains in our program. And if you don't make material gains in your program, they say there's something wrong with your program. So we had a house, and we replaced all of that Salvation Army furniture that we had gotten when we first came home, just room by room. And as we made the money, we furnished a room. And we moved in there with 6 children, all girls. And then came Vietnam, and our oldest son went to Vietnam, and that was devastating because he was wounded just before I went to the 1969 conference as delegate. And the whole conference in New York prayed for my son. And he came back. Yes, he had been wounded, but not seriously, and he's a fine young man today. Our oldest daughter married a hippie. Those were the hippie days. He had red hair where you can't grow hair, I'm sure. You know. But we gave her a lovely backyard wedding, and 3 months later she came home and she said, I can't share my bed with another woman. And she divorced and was single until just 5 or 6 years ago she married again. The next daughter, I explain as my power of example. I can only be a power of example to my family that I'm sober and I'm going to stay sober. And you can depend upon me as a mom, a wife, or a friend. And Robbie used the excuse of you hadn't gone to prison when I was 12 years old, I wouldn't be using drugs like LSD and all this other stuff. And she went on her little trek for about 3 years. And she was all over the country on all kinds of drugs in all kinds of hospitals. And we took her all to every psychiatrist in Columbus, Ohio, and they couldn't do anything. And finally we had to let her go. And then she came back, and we went all through that trek again, and we ended up probating her to the state hospital with all those other drooling old ladies. She kind of woke up, and it wasn't long after that that she came off the drugs and came into the program. And she's a lovely young lady today with a family also. We've had several daughters, Jane and Teresa, that joined the Air Force instead of going to college. We've educated a few. We bought a whole lot of new Toyotas. But we only buy it and get it tagged and get the payment book, and then you get the payment book. And that's been fun. We lived in Ohio and never thought that it made much difference. But really, that little bit of guilt was always there every time we went by that jailhouse and by that courthouse. So in 1972, we moved to Hilton Head Island, South Carolina. And my husband again became a home builder and went into business and built an awful lot of homes on Hilton Head. We had a lot of fun there. As I say, we educated the kids that wanted to be educated and did what we had to do as a family. She told you that I've been active in all phases of alcoholism and carrying the AA message. So what is your responsibility if you're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous? I challenge each of you to put a big book in your local library. Put a set of books in your local library. What is your group doing to plant the seed somewhere? How often are you on the diverter that takes the calls from the central office? What is your bag? You know, not everybody has the gift of gab like I do. It doesn't bother me to get up here, but it might bother you. So there's a place for you to do whatever. What is your expertise? Yes, I started the Midwinter Conference on Hilton Head, and it's alive and well and 13 years old, because they wouldn't go to conferences, and I wanted them to enjoy the beauty of a weekend like this. And it's been a lot of fun. The International Women's Conference, the flyers are in my room, I'll bring them over, rotates around the country. It's an international conference, and it runs somewhere between 1,500 and 2,000 women every year. It's always Valentine's Day weekend or right around that time. This year we're going to Omaha, Nebraska. This past year, yes, in February, I was in the Marriott Marquis for a long weekend through a blizzard, and I had a ball. We had meetings around the clock, and it was wonderful. I didn't have to go out, but the young people enjoyed the snow. They went out. So there again, you know, what do you enjoy doing? I enjoy conferences. I enjoy going. And in 1992, I hosted as chairperson the International Women's Conference, and at that time we were living in Reno. In 88, we ran away from the kids in the East and moved to Reno, Nevada, and we spent four wonderful years out there, and we just came back in 92. And now we're in Columbia, and I'm stirring something up. I haven't decided what yet. I don't know whether we'll start up a camping weekend or go for a big hotel weekend, but we'll do something. We'll have something going within the year, probably. I have made an awful lot of friends in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they're nothing like the friends I had at the bar. And the women at the bar never came to see me or sent me a card or anything like that. But my AA friends keep track of me now, and for that I'm very grateful. And as I told you, I'm married to the same guy, and he is really my best buddy. And he doesn't appreciate me going to conferences where he can't go. We'll have to get him a tape deck. But he's a wonderful man, and we enjoy good health. We go to the fitness center together, and we do things together. And it's been a great life, and it can be your life if you're 39 years old and just coming into the program. But it's your choice. You become responsible for your actions, but not only for your actions, your happiness. If you're down, why are you down? What do you need to do to get up? I get out every day. You know, it makes no difference that I'm 70. I'm up and showered and dressed and out every day. And I'm very grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous for giving me the knowledge and the wherewithal to live life as a mature woman. And I can stand proud. And I'm just very grateful that it's Thursday night and I can enjoy the rest of the weekend, and I know that all of you will. And I'd like to thank you again for having me.